said his father, scrambling out of the grave.
Go on. The last foot is yours.
He slid into the hole. The earth was hard as a dish. This was where his mother would rest until the day the gods returned.
No tears in the grave, boy. That's for later, when we've had some rum.
You'll let me drink rum?
If you stop digging like a girl, I might. Oh, quit bawling. It's a joke. You're a fine, strong boy. She'd be proud. You can help carve her gravestone, too.
They buried his mother as the scriptures required, without a coffin, in a shroud of undyed wool. The stone was a mere field stone, dragged into place behind the mules, but when the chiseling was done, her name looked beautiful and permanent, and his father said they could come there and talk with her for the rest of their days. After sunset, men came for the orphans. It was the last time Condri would ever watch the strange ritual unfold. Their father paid them, something his mother had never done. No names were spoken. Condri's father told him to give the older girl his shoes.
What will I wear, then?
Cow pies, you rascal. Now take those sorry things off.
Later they sat at table and gnawed the flatbread his mother had baked the week before. The old man produced a flask and shared it with Condri, not bothering with cups. He told stories about the dead woman, who had come west with her people out of the great desert of Uroth. He poked Condri in the chest.
You're part sand panther, boy. In all the 400 clans of Uroth, you'll find no tougher stock. And one day you'll prove it.
But he would not say a word about his courtship with Condri's mother, or why they had lived here like squatters on the chilly mountainside while he came and went. Condri had never tasted alcohol. He found himself babbling, then angry, then simply undone by grief. He lost the thread of the old man's words, which meandered over scores of subjects without revealing very much. One last remark did emerge through the haze of that night, however. Condri recalled it later because it seemed so baldly untrue.
Your home, said his father. Don't speak ill of it, Condri.
I just said it was cold.
Not the mountaintop, you fool. I mean the continent, all Uroth. There's hunger here, and too much bloodshed, and ignorance on those. But there should never be shame. We lit the fire that warms the world today. Architecture, writing, music, mathematics, law. Do you know what made those things possible?
He tapped his forehead.
Urothi minds, boy. We were dancing before the outer world learned to walk.
Mathematics? Said Condri.
His father nodded.
You heard me.
Condri looked down at the cracked plate his mother had repaired 5 or 6 times with a weak glue of bone marrow and mud. The wind moaned over the desolate fields.
What happened? He said.
The curve of his father's mouth flattened into a line. He took the flask from Condri's hand.
Many things happened. Plague happened, and the world blamed Uroth. And there was more to it than that. Violence, plunder. But go to sleep now.
Someone plundered our mathematics, said Condri.
His father's fist smashed down on the table, making saucers jump. Condri jerked away. He did not quite believe that his father would harm him, but he was appalled by the misery on the old man's face.
I would ask you, said his father, through his teeth, to respect the land you come from. Can you remember that?
Yes, Papa.
Then go to sleep.
Condri went, his eyes moist again. He hated the old man, for lying about Uroth, for leaving them here on the mountain, for shedding no tears of his own. But in the dead of night, he snapped awake, imagining that someone had whispered his name. Finding himself alone nonetheless, he rose and looked out the window, and there was his father, kneeling in the dirt, rocking by his dead wife's grave. The next morning, Lantor Hingeman brought Condri and the cook down into the splendor of the Satapre Valley, with its lilacs and hummingbirds and smells of the life-giving sea. Condrey was frightened. Everything was decadent and damp. Frogs croaked in gullies. The wooden signs at the crossroads trailed beards of great-green moss. The village names were odd and menacing. Wolfkill, Bitter Moon, Blind Stream.
"This is the one," said his father. "Blind Stream Village. Welcome home."
The place was anything but blind. Faces peeped at them from cane thickets, curtained windows, over garden walls. Dogs snarled. Roosters hurled war screams at the sky.
"Papa," he said, "can I tell my new family about the toys?"
The cook hissed through her teeth. Lantor Hingeman stopped the cart and put his hand on the back of Condrey's neck. It might have been a loving gesture, but the hand, the whole arm, were as rigid as wood.
"Absolutely never," he said.
The house, when at last they reached it, loomed impossibly large. There were outer gates and inner gardens, breezeways, porches, a copper sundial, a balcony with a cast-iron rail. Condrey heard laughter, doors slamming, bare feet on stone. Through the nearest gate he saw brown faces, young and old, assembling in a row. His father opened the gate and dragged him into the courtyard.
"This is Condrey, your brother,"
he told his six other children.
"Welcome, brother,"
they screamed, impassive, obviously coached. Two ancient aunts mumbled prayers. An even more ancient man tapped his cane upon the stone. Condrey's stomach churned. His old cook was led away into the house. A hound sniffed at his crotch. A smiling, slender-cheeked woman gave his cheeks a ritual dab of rose water. His father cleared his throat and said that Condrey should call her mother now. Stepmother, he thought. Replacement mother. Fake. But the woman scolded her husband.
"That's not up to you, old man."
Then she fixed her big, lambent eyes on Condrey.
"My name is Diakra. I'll be your mother if you'll have me. But we have a duty to your birth mother as well, child. You must honor her memory. I must honor her place in this family and the gift she's given us today. So call me mother if you want to. But sometimes also call me Sepu, second mother. It will help us remember the one who came before. She will be a bond between us, not a wall."
Condrey bowed his head, astonished. It had never occurred to him that such kindness could exist.
"Lovely, charming," said his father. "Now come and meet your Sepu's pack of weasels."
Six new siblings. Four girls, all younger, one boy still in diapers, and a second boy a little taller than Condrey, though slightly crooked at the ribs. This boy stepped out in front of the others. His upper lip curled, his eyes locked on the newcomer, this novelty his father had produced from thin air. Condrey could not tell if he was elated or appalled.
"You and Mektu are the same age," said the old man. "From now on, we'll celebrate your birthdays together. Lend him those shoes, Mech, until we go shopping in town."
"What'll I wear?"
said Mektu. Morning. A smell of bile and cinders haunts Eternity Camp. Condrey is climbing the ladder of an eastern watchtower, which happens to be at the center of a camel stockade. The animals churn below him under a mantle of flies, bellowing and screaming for their morning meal. Condrey feels strong and clear-headed. To his surprise, he has slept like the dead. It is midwinter, the gentlest season in central Uroth. The light is crystalline, the savage heat still many weeks away. The crescent bushes that surround the camp have opened flowers small as melon seeds, and swarms of stingless wasps have appeared to lap the bounty of their juices. It cannot last, Condrey knows. Already this morning, the wind is flowing west out of the infinite desert, slow and determined, a foretaste of that scorching wind the villagers call Amiyuk, the dry-mouthed kiss. He pushes open the trapdoor. The two soldiers on the tower platform have to shuffle aside. One is a youth of no more than 18. He is fresh from the Satapre, his skin still flush with the valley's abundant water, his expression one of perpetual, if muted, shock. The other soldier is Mektu. He scarcely glances at Khandri. He is rolling a cheroot on the rail.
"Corporal Hingeman," says the new recruit to Khandri. "I chewed a silverwood twig like you told me, sir. For my throat. It stopped hurting. Thank you, sir."
"Don't mention it," says Khandri. "You're relieved."
"Corporal Alar's supposed to relieve me.
We traded posts. Go on, get some breakfast." The youth takes a dubious glance from the rail.
"I'll wait until they feed the camels, sir. Those sons of bitches, they bite."
"Only if they think you're a luli," says Mektu.
"You have to stand your ground, and if one of them bites you, take a stick and beat the shit out of him. It won't happen again."
They bustle the youth down the ladder. Alone, neither brother finds his voice. The camels bump and jostle the tower. Mektu smokes. Khandri picks up the telescope and trains it on the south.
"Dust on the road," he says at last. "That's the 5th Legion," says Mektu.
"Is it, by damn?"
"The last of them, anyway. Most cross the Obic in the night."
Khandri has them in focus now, a few thousand men trudging south along the distant river, in ragged clothes but tight formation. Bound for Kiprifa, a rain-blessed land of green pastures and rice paddies, taken with ease 4 years ago. Khandri feels a burning envy of the 5th Legion's soldiers. They would see nothing of the Galsinae campaign.
"The Tallis apply to join a mounted division. The Shessel Cavalry," he says.
Khandri shakes his head.
"No one's going to put that man on a horse."
"Listen, Mech, I know," says his brother.
"I have to stop talking about an escape." "Well, quit your worrying. I can keep my mouth shut."
Khandri sighs.
"No, you can't."
As if on cue, Mektu grumbles.
"Not as if you have a better plan."
"Suicide's a better plan," says Khandri.
"Find a mirror. Take a look at your eyes." "You can only see the stains up close," says Mektu. "And the valley's a big place. We can stay away from Blind Stream. Ma can say she doesn't know where we are."
"While they're tearing out her fingernails." Mektu's body twitches. He hides his face in the crook of his elbow, a gesture he has made since childhood when overcome with feeling. Then he lowers his arm and blinks down at the camels.
"You're right," he says.
After a moment, Khandri says,
"You were right about something, too. The offensive." "I'm right about lots of things," Mektu shouts. "I'm right about the Yatra. You don't believe in them. That's fine. Be a fool. But you have to laugh." "Lower your fucking voice," hisses Khandri.
"I won't laugh anymore. But promise me you'll drop this shit about desertion." Mektu's cheroot has gone out. He sucks at it anyway, then flings it down at the camels. After a moment, he says,
"Do you still think about her?"
"About Ma? You have to ask?"
"Not Ma."
Khandri grows still. He lowers the telescope. He feels as though Mektu has just turned and kicked him in the gut.
"Of course I do," he says. "I dreamed of her last night," says Mektu. "We were on her cousin's porch. She was playing the bandolier. I think her feet were in my lap."
For the first time that morning, he turns and looks at Khandri.
"Do you dream about her?" he asks.
Khandri is seething.
"What kind of shit question is that?" "Yes, sometimes." "She said she loved me. Did she ever say that to you?"
"I don't want to talk about her, Mech."
"She said it more than once."
"Then I guess she loved you. Now shut up!" The second silence is deeper. All the well-being Khandri brought with him to the tower is gone.
Love is an illness, a savage enchantment.
He raises the telescope again. The lands about him are beautiful, blinding, cruel. Eternity Camp squats at the center of the Milea, or Wind Plain. A sparse grassland, dabbed here and there with stands of brush, solitary vilk trees like giant crones buried to their necks, button cacti, villages of thirsty Chiloto goat herds. The prophet rules the whole of the Malaya. She rules the lands beyond it also, in every direction, as far as the eye can see. It could not have been otherwise. Heaven has singled her out. Ong and Serthong, supreme gods of life and death, respectively, have jointly informed her of her fate. She will be empress and lawgiver to the continent of Uroth. She will restore this land to glory and see it mocked no more by outlanders, nor starved by their quarantine. East of Eternity Camp, the grasslands start to die. There is a palsied 12-mile swath where a few villages scratch out a living, then dead earth, then clay, and finally, 16 miles off, the glittering white of the Skralim, the stolen sea. It is a place of death. The Skralim, a monstrous canyon that was once a true sea, until the rivers that fed it were diverted by the Khosraj. Beyond it somewhere are the nations of the Lutaral, still unconquered, and beyond that the desert, wider than the reach of any tales. Condry swings around to face west. The mountains of the coastal range, the high wall between him and home. His gaze lingers on the peaks. White mists, here and there a wink of snow. He picks out Green Pass, where the road leaps the ridge and starts its winding descent to the Satapre Valley and the sea. The pass Mektu claimed he could reach on a fast horse before anyone noticed that he was gone. A fast horse. The thought rekindles Condry's anger. "Has no one ever told you," he says aloud, "that the Rasanga's stallions can outrun any other horse in this army?" Mektu grunts, a concession. The Rasanga are the Prophet's elite commandos and the deadliest killers in the Army of Revelation. "If you think for one instant that you could steal one of those horses..." "I don't," says Mektu. "You couldn't steal a sandcat either. The damn thing would kill and eat you. You might be able to steal a camel or some common horse, but even then, they'd catch you soon enough." "Khan," says Mektu, "do you want to stay here until we die?" To Condry's irritation, he has no ready answer. Mektu glances at him, fidgets, tries to straighten his spine. "I thought Arikina..."
"You bastard.
We have to talk about her someday, Condry. I thought she might have gone to Loro Canyon, or the Cotton Towns. If we went there together, if we asked around..." Condry could throw him from the tower. "She didn't go either of those places. We'd have heard. She went..." He forces the words out through his teeth. "Somewhere very far away."
"Do you think she's dead?"
"God damn it, no!"
"I don't know why you're so certain. Did she tell you something?"
"You're fucking cracked.
The old man was strange too, wasn't he, when he learned that she was gone? You remember? He looked guilty.
We should have stood up to him then. But we could try again with her cousins, or the people at the clinic, or her aunt. Someone knows and isn't talking. A person doesn't live her whole life in a place and just disappear. She had no enemies. Everyone loved her. What's the matter with you, brother? Are you sick?"
"Mac," he says, turning away,
"nobody knows where she went." After his shift in the watchtower, Condry's captain puts him to work on the perimeter defenses. Beyond the wall of fishhook thorns, an earthen trench encircles the camp. The trench is divided into sections, each of which is filled waist-deep with palm fronds dipped in thick black oil. If the camp were ever besieged, any section could be set ablaze with little more than a match. Such barriers discourage the Prophet's enemies, but not so the yellow mole rat, whose relentless digging crumbles the walls of the trench. Condry and his team are walking the trench floor, stuffing arsenic-laced bread into the rodent's burrows and sealing them with clay. It is a job he detests. The rats have other exits. Some crawl out to die twitching in the moonlight. Condry's clothes, his skin, will reek of oil for a week. Mektu, as usual, has been sent to the kitchens. Gondry can picture him, grating yams, shelling palm nuts, sweating over cauldrons of soup. This morning they had parted bitterly.
"You used to care about her," Mektu had accused. "You used to grin like a fool every time she walked into a room. I was almost jealous."
"Almost?"
"I should have stopped you. Told you to find your own girl, but now it's like she never existed. You won't even say her name."
The last jab is true enough. For 3.5 years, Condry has avoided speaking her name in Mektu's presence, anyone's presence. He has tried not to say it even to himself. And for 3.5 years, Mektu has respected that silence. As well he fucking should. Now the truce is broken, the silence gone. He will hear her footfall everywhere, hear her breathing when he breathes. At night she will speak his name with quiet laughter, drive him over hills and swamps and badlands until he wakes, bereft, groping at the air or holding his dick like a talisman, watching her fade with those sordid dreamscapes in an eye blink or two. Even then, he will not say it. Her name, Arikina, will be the word that dances on the tip of his tongue, the clear note above the harangues and recitations, the sour trumpets, the curses and cackling and threats. Arikina, the name that stitches all the scraps of him together into something he admires, something worth the trouble to recall. Too late, he's smiling. Broad daylight in this stinking trench, and yet she's here with him, leaning close, forcing him to meet her eye.
"The spark, Condry. You can't hide it from me."
The twitch at her lips' left corner, so small and private. He will pay for this memory with tears.
"Benjamin's thought of a joke," says the man to his right. "Either that or he's cracking before my eyes. Make it a joke, will you, Valley Boy? The filthier, the better."
He stuffs poison into the earth. He slaps in clay. This morning he lied to Mektu. A lie he has often repeated. A lie of which he cannot repent. Arikina did vanish, of course. Vanished utterly. And the Satapre Valley grieved. Hundreds of men and women searched the countryside. From the lowlands to the peaks and even beyond. Her aunt consulted oracles. Offered a reward. Her cousins wept. The priest who had tried to prevent her from studying medicine wept. Nurses at her clinic for indigents wept. Patients rose from their sickbeds to join the search. Doctors who had tried to seduce her wept on the shoulders of their wives. Mektu's tears were open taps. He shouted at anyone who would listen that he had planned to marry Arikina, that she was the blossom of the valley and the woman of his destiny and dreams. And Condry wept in secret, his grief walled in like these rats. He never once told Arikina that he loved her. Not when he first understood. Not when they began to lie about their walks in the hills, hiding from Mektu, hiding the stains on their clothes. Not when her eyes grew moist and she spoke of her own love, saying she trusted him with her weakness, her ugliness, the parts of her she couldn't love herself. Not when orthodox revelation swept the valley, and the hour grew so obviously late. Not when Arikina took a copper ring from the neck of a fever syrup bottle and slipped it onto his thumb with a laugh.
"Now I have you, Condry Hingeman. That's a totem ring. I'm the master of your soul."
Not when they kissed a moment later and he thought, "My soul? Keep it. Why else would I need it? I never noticed it before." Not on their last night together. Not when she told him, a matter of hours before she vanished, exactly where she meant to go. The shift ends at sundown. There are barrels of water for the trench crew. Condry strips and scrubs, racing against the night's oncoming chill. Racing, too, against the time of evening prayer. The great bell in the Palace of Radiance will toll at any moment, and he is still far from his unit. He is in no danger of reprimand. Prayers may be offered anywhere outdoors, but he is in danger of going hungry, again. If his comrades beat him to the dinner line, he will be left with scraps. Condry jogs across the camp, searching for landmarks. He barely knows this sector. Latrines, armories, endless identical tents, a lumberyard, an archery range. The horror of the blackworm pits somewhere off to his right. Already men are gathering in the open areas, facing north, hushed before the evening rites. Condry weaves among the warehouses, the drab canvas triangles. The orange sky has faded to gray. Oh, flaming shit. Wrong turn. A high brick wall blocks his path. Desperate now, he follows it north, wondering what it encloses, how much of a detour it entails. Then his luck turns. Just ahead is an iron gate, heavy and imposing, but ajar. Perhaps they will let him through just this once. Inside, a wooden stool, but no sentry. No one at all. Condry pokes in his head and sees a great dusty courtyard, entirely walled. The yard is a curious shape, an octagon, in fact. It is quite empty, save for an ornate little structure at the center, with a gabled roof and narrow windows. Condry squints. A shrine? A carriage, stripped of its wheels? Well, there are the guards, anyway. Half a dozen, straight across the courtyard, by the only other gate. Condry waves, but they do not see him. They are assembling for prayers themselves. To hell with this. He's famished. He steps into the courtyard and makes right for them. The gate was open, brothers. No one was there, and I couldn't shout to you at prayer time, could I? That is what he will say if they are angry. But perhaps they won't be angry. Perhaps they are people he knows. Clang! The brass thunder of the first bell. The summons. I'm so hungry, brothers. I've not even tasted any boar. Have mercy. One day you'll need kindness, too. His path brings him closer to the ornate structure. It is neither shrine nor carriage, but something odder still. A palanquin, such as one sees in drawings of the bad old days of the occupation, or even the empire. Something for sartaffs to ride about in, on the shoulders of slaves. The object is lavish, with faded gilt trim and stone inlay that must surely gleam in the daylight. The windows are barred. Heavy bolts and padlocks secure the doors. Faint lines in the dust of the courtyard. Vague chalk shapes. Circle, triangle, square. All of them centered on the palanquin. And by its locked door, fresh flowers. Something he has never seen in Eternity Camp. He should stay well clear. He does not. His running feet have their own ideas. A quick look, that's all. Then the far gate, his plea to the sentries. One glance. He will not even stop. Or perhaps for only an instant. Just long enough to see. There is no glass in the window. Only those heavy bars. Inside there is no finery, nor even any seats. The palanquin contains just one object. An urn. Lidded, massive, carved from cold white stone. The urn has no markings of any kind. All at once, Condry knows that he has made a terrible mistake. Nothing has visibly changed, but a dreadful unease has pounced on him, like the moment before a massacre. He wants to run, but something, is it guilt, is it fear, slows him to a wobbly march. And now the guards see him. They are leaping, waving. Not one of them makes a sound. He slows still more. He is walking under water, against the current, very nearly adrift. The silence is hideous. Something behind him does not want him to go. Then a sound does reach him. But is he dreaming? Of course, gods of death. It isn't real. It's his fancy. He has not just heard the scraping of stone. Why has he stopped? Another sound from behind him now. A child's voice, high and meandering. The voice of a small girl talking to herself. Clang! The second bell. Instantly free of whatever madness afflicted him, Condry races to the gate in a transport of joy. Brothers, he starts to whisper. But no, that is forbidden. It is the moment of prayer. They are on their knees, arms raised to the northern sky, murmuring the first words of the evening canticle. Condry joins them, melting with gratitude. He is safe.
He is kneeling with his 30,000 comrades. What does a soldier of revelation have to fear?
For 10 long minutes, peace reigns in his heart. Then the prayer is over, and the guards explode to their feet. Two run headlong for the gate by which Condrey entered, steering well around the palanquin. The other four, among them a lieutenant, lift Condrey and slam him against the wall.
"You little fuck!" snaps the officer. "What in pitfire are you doing here?"
"That's Condrey Hingeman," says a private. "He's the brother of that cuckoo bird."
"The gate was open, sir," says Condrey.
"The padlock's faulty," snarls the lieutenant.
"We were repairing it, filing it down."
The other soldiers are whispering together, and all at once Condrey knows that they are not only furious, but afraid.
"I'm sorry, lieutenant," he says. "I don't know anything about this place. I just needed a shortcut."
"A shortcut? Why, you prick!"
"What's in the urn, sir?"
"Is it the Yatra? Did her radiance trap it? I won't tell."
"Listen to him. Gods, he thinks we have the fucking Yatra. Hingemans," says the private.
"I know that family, sir. Back in the Satapre, they're always in trouble. His brother Mektu..."
"Shut up."
The lieutenant's eyes scan the courtyard.
"Did anyone see you, corporal?"
"No, sir. Not one soul."
The lieutenant reaches behind his back and unsheathes a knife. Condrey stiffens. The men holding him tighten their grip. The lieutenant rests the point of the blade on Condrey's neck.
"That gate was not left unguarded," he says.
"Yes, sir."
"That gate is always locked. You saw nothing. You were never here."
"Yes, lieutenant. I mean, no, sir, never."
"Look me in the eye, Hingeman. Can I count on you?"
"I was never here, sir. I swear on my mother. I swear on the mother of us all."
The lieutenant draws a deep breath and suddenly smiles.
"That's just fine, then. Let him go. On your fast fucking way, Corporal Hingeman."
He is very nearly the last to arrive. As the dinner line inches forward, he sees his brother through the open side of the kitchen tent, washing dishes under the moth-crowded lamps. Mektu is in fine form, laughing, shouting.
"What about the afterlife, brothers? Will there be nipples, do you think? And will we be allowed to touch them? And what about our scars? Our dirty nicknames, belching contests, tattoos?"
The other workers cringe, avert their eyes.
"Anyway," Mektu adds with a shrug, "we'll know the truth soon enough."
When at last he is served, more than scraps, but not much more, Condrey sits on a stump and wolfs his food. He is still shaking, and his mouth feels numb. Something horrifying has occurred. But did it happen in the palanquin, or in the dark box of his mind? Is he feverish? Did he swallow rat poison somehow? These are comforting thoughts, given the alternative. But even if he was temporarily mad, and the white urn's lid never scraped open, and that sing-song child's voice never called out, even then, something must explain an antique litter in a walled courtyard, and the fear in those men. He decides to take himself in hand.
"No business of yours, Corporal. Not your sector, and you've just sworn to hold your tongue. Besides, you have enough to worry about. Your brother's death wish, for starters."
He cleans his plate with a last bit of flatbread. He will have to threaten Mektu into silence. He has tried everything else. But that will not be easy. Mektu is no coward and does not take well to threats. He hears his brother's whinny of a laugh. An irritating laugh. And that, too, is a problem. Some men die for heresy, others because their mannerisms grate on the nerves. Mektu could die for either. A mid-level officer's mess is just a few yards away. But luck is with Mektu tonight, for as the meal ends, there are cries of alarm. Plates are dropped, orders howled, buckets filled from any source whatsoever, including the soup cauldron. Everyone breaks into a mad stampede. The Yatra has set fire to the prophet's house. Condrey, bucketless, races to the scene. The rumor is horrifying, thrilling. Could she possibly be in danger? If the building collapses, what then? Surely the gods will let her pass through the fire unscathed. The gate of the palace compound stands open to the wider camp. Loud cries of Olduce Pom Di Ang, Ang loves the Enlightened One, echo among the walls. Thousands have squeezed already into the old gallows courtyard, cheering and chanting, surrounding the prophet's tiny house. Atop its thatched roof, 20 men with empty buckets dance and cheer, as if at some great victory. A little smoke hangs in the air, but the fire is dead. From his spot at the edge of the courtyard, Khandri can see no damage at all. One of the roof dancers lifts his hands in exultation.
Yatra! Yatra! He shouts. Flee our mistress, who scours evil from the earth! Flee, Eternity Camp! Flee her anger and go your lonely way!
The soldiers below give an answering roar.
Flee! Flee!
Khandri cannot bring himself to shout. There are no Yatras. The whole army has gone mad. Then his nose wrinkles at a familiar scent. Clove oil. He looks over his shoulder. The pusher Skem is an arm's length away. For a moment, they are both quite still. Then the waxman speaks. Khandri cannot hear him over the roaring, but Skem enunciates slowly, letting Khandri read his lips. Dead man. Khandri flashes him a bare-toothed snarl. Now that he has a mortal enemy, he knows he must be taken for a lunatic, a man capable of any horror, a man the practical Skem will choose not to provoke. An eager killer, that is. The opposite of the truth. The crowd gives a violent surge, pressing Khandri against the wall. Twisting, he sees that the prophet herself has stepped into the courtyard. She moves at the center of her phalanx of Rasanga commandos, gripping the chain of her cherished white baboon. The roaring stops, a snuffed candle. The Enlightened One moves with mincing steps. As always, she wears a wrap of blood-red wool, stripes of white grease paint on her face and forearms, and the necklace of dog's fangs that symbolized the martyrdom of her people. Short, thin, wrinkled, a woman slight enough to be carried away on the breeze. Her eyes are wandering, her dry lips slack. She might well be unaware of the crowd. It is a face both haunted and frail, but the whole world knows the speed with which those eyes can awaken to deadly purpose. Those lips form words of holy rage. The crowd squeezes farther back. 40 Rasanga with spears and swords, crossbows and mataglins glare at the soldiers as if daring them to look at their mistress askance. Up close they are terrible to behold. Enormous, scarred from old battles, shoulders like the haunches of bears. Rasanga, innocent dreamers. Each one chosen personally by the prophet, and each entrusted with a glimpse of her ethereal visions. Strangest of all, about two-thirds of the Rasanga are women. Khandri has never understood this. Everyone knows that the gods disapprove of women soldiers. The barbarous Vajeks send their women out to kill, but Chilotos tolerate no such obscenity. And yet, here they are, women Rasanga, the deadliest fighters alive. Once, greatly daring, Khandri had asked his captain to explain the contradiction. The man's response was cryptic.
Rasanga are more than human, Corporal. They are changed by faith, by their encounter with the holy mysteries. Our rules don't apply.
The tightest ring around the prophet, however, is reserved for her sons, the sons of heaven, lords of the Orthodox dominion. No father sired these boys. Revelation alone kindled life in her womb. The elder sons are the prophet's ministers, war counselors, interrogators, and executioners at need. The Chiloto people pray for them, and cry out in joy or terror when they pass, knowing they will one day rule the continent. Khandri stands on his toes. He cannot tell just how many of the 11 sons are here in the crowd, but there for starters is Lord Jihalkra, the firstborn. Tall and severe, with bright eyes and a broad, chiseled forehead, he wears a salt-white desert tunic fastened with ebony pins. Jihalkra the Silent, he is called. Each of the sons has such a title. He is the army's field marshal, the manager of all the war's far-flung campaigns. Jihalkra studies the men on the roof with grim disapproval. Instantly, like whipped boys, they turn and rush for the ladders. Then the prophet speaks. Not in her terrible war voice. This is a murmur, audible only because no one is breathing.
"Little one," she says to the enormous baboon, "what has happened to my men? Something has stolen all their tongues."
A rebuke. The soldiers freeze for an excruciating instant. Then a frightened voice cries out,
"Her feet walk heaven's path!"
The prophet allows herself a smile. The crowd erupts, repeating the blessing 7 times. Khandri shouts as loud as anyone. He stands just yards from her, after all. The white baboon puts its head back and screeches. Its mistress studies the creature with concern.
"Gently, sleepyhead. I'm not leaving for heaven just yet. And you shall go with me when the time comes."
The baboon's name is Sleepyhead. It is rumored to have developed a taste for human flesh. Khandri knows for a fact that the creature attends executions, crying and leaping and running circles on its chain. The prophet is rarely without it. Her servants, regularly mauled by the animal, taste its food for poison as they do the prophet's own. The enlightened one steps closer. Khandri curses himself for letting the mob sweep him into the courtyard. With great effort, he slides 1 foot in the direction of the gates. He sees the hard, flint faces of her younger sons, the medals on their chests, the savage eyes of the dreamers, who seem enraged to find no one to kill among the soldiers. And there, by damn, is Garatajik. This is a much rarer sighting. Garatajik the Merciful, the learned son, the mystery, the one who reads. Even now he is clutching several books to his chest. Perhaps they were in his mother's house, and he feared to lose them in the fire. Garatajik is the second-born son of heaven. Like Jihalkra, he is over 40 years old. He is perhaps the least dangerous of the brothers. Out of 11 rattlesnakes, 1 must be least dangerous, and the only one not to serve in his mother's wars. He has returned but recently to the camp, out of the distant east, along with a few strange, bookish men and 40 emaciated nomads. The prophet had shed tears of joy, embraced him in public, made him gifts of gold and horses and weapons and wives. Garatajik had been missing for 2 years. Now the frail woman stops, and her entourage with her. She raises a spidery hand, glass bangles dropping past her elbow, and the hush that falls is total.
"I do not fear this thief of souls," she says. "Nor should you, believers. Fear is idleness. Fear is sand blown under the door. But are we helpless, that we cannot seal the crack beneath the door?"
A pause, in which the men dare no more than slight shakes of their heads.
"Like that whisper of sand," she continues, "death seeps in through the crevice of fear. But for those who know revelation, there is no final death. True, this Yatra is a mighty one. I sensed it, away there beyond the stolen sea, raging in the desert, among the dry wells and wastes of sulfur and the tombs picked clean by ghouls. This Yatra drifted for centuries. Bodiless, it cursed the winds, cursed the sun, burrowed under dunes by daylight. It thirsted, not for water, not for wine or even blood. It longed for green grass, my soldiers. It thirsted for the west. But it erred when it invaded my camp."
She twists her body, waves a hand at the roof.
"The little stings it has dealt us? Nothing. Nothing. They were inflicted in our sleep. But we are awake now, and we will slap and crush this Yatra, or drive it back into the sand. It is the will of heaven. No man or spirit or plague or storm can turn us aside. My son, Ojulon, he is not here tonight. My son takes any woman he wants. The virgins, the most fertile, they praise the gods when he enters them, and the force of his love.
She stops, gazing at them almost with accusation. The mob holds its breath. Khandri fights the urge to glance at his fellow soldiers. To do so, even to shift his eyeballs left and right, would be unutterably dangerous. But some of them, surely, are seeing what he sees. For never before has her madness been so plain, exposed like a boil on her cheek. He feels ashamed for her and wishes he could run. My son, Ojulon, not here tonight. That's one blessing at least. For Ojulon, her favorite, worst of the rattlesnakes, would have found some excuse for bloodshed in the chaos of the fire. But where is the maniac anyway? Is he indifferent to his mother's fate? Is he up in the palace, surrounded by courtesans, fondling that golden knife? Radiant mother, cries Garatajik, his schoolmaster's voice, water dashed in all their faces. Night has fallen, and the great boar is roasting on the spit. May we send your loyal soldiers to their feast? The prophet gazes at him, startled, then slowly lowers her hand.
You may go, she says. My son is right. This night is for feasting and joy. So go. Go and find some. Eat the pig. The day comes all too soon.
Uncertain shuffling. Khandri takes another step toward the gates. They are dismissed, surely. They may quit her holy presence with a murmured blessing and a bow. Then it happens. The prophet's eyes grow wide. The hand stabs skyward again, and her body straightens and stands tall. A wild passion lights her features. The voice that comes from her now is a shriek that rends the air.
On wings of flame that day is coming, and the flame that is our cause will scour clean this land, and all lands everywhere, all the known and secret places, the forest depths of Bathia, the castles of the heretics, the mountains of the Khasraj, the dark floor of the sea. And those who cling to false ways will earn oblivion. Are we to wallow in their filth? Do we wait for pigs to shamble from our path? Our path is molten silver. We strike no bargains. We sweep the animals aside. The earth shall vomit up her dead. The white child shall awaken. The land suffer the torture of the wind. Flesh melt from the bone, and the small blind beggars will crawl to us, sobbing, and the twin abominations dwell in Uroth once more. No matter. They will know our strength when we are done. Go and feast, you men!
She is breathless, swaying. Unsurprisingly, no one moves so much as a finger. Then her eyes flash with rage.
I am the keeper of the Immaculate Law. Go and feast!
In less than a minute, the courtyard is deserted. Khandri lives with a double certainty. No one could possibly love the prophet. No one could fail to love the prophet. She is a diseased and monstrous animal. She is the liberator, mother and father to them all. She ignores the most sacred beliefs of the Chiloto nation. She is that nation's holy core. She is the giver of shelter, the voice of love. She kills with a tireless commitment. It is her love which makes her kill. Before her, the Chilotos had never once found a leader who was not soon slain, or put in irons, or devoured by leprosy, or bought. They assumed contempt. They were a dirty, dung-collecting, artless people of a vast but marginal land, the source of slaves and foot soldiers, goat herds, horse thieves, warlords who were lords of nothing and made war mostly on themselves. True, their coast was green and fertile, but in the eyes of Uroth, this splinter of land was the exception that proved the rule, Chiloto. The people themselves knew the word meant the honest ones in their own language, but they were helpless to deny the common Kasraji meaning. Disorder, a mess or accident, something spilled. They were the accidental people, the stain on Uroth, whom the great southern clans would not allow even to tend their cattle, and northern princes and sartaffs ran down for sport, as they did antelope or deer. The ones all armies hacked their way through, languid and complaining, on their way to worthier foes. The prophet declared an end to all that. She was the god's chosen instrument and never flinched from the task. She united the people no one could unite. In her prisons are Vajeks who castrated Chiloto men with hot irons, who burned the vilk trees that housed the souls of Chiloto ancestors, who sorted Chiloto women according to their suitability for rape. Or so her troops are told. Khandri has witnessed none of these things, and in recent years, as declaring love for the prophet changed from a collective impulse to a mode of survival, it has been hard to tell memory from fancy. An old man sells you matches and speaks of Vajek crimes. Are they what he remembers, or what he knows he is expected to remember? And how long before the two begin to merge? Of course, Khandri too has loved the prophet, all his life. On Candle Mountain, his birth mother Uthe told him to thank the gods each night for the gift of the Enlightened One. When his father appeared in the household, he reminded Khandri that if the prophet had not led the fight against the Vajeks, they would all be enslaved, or conscripted, or dead. And just days after Uthe's death and Khandri's arrival in Blind Stream, Mektu took him aside and whispered, "We're not orthodox here, but that doesn't mean we love the prophet any less. Some pigs in school are jealous because we're sophisticated people. They lie. They say Hingemans think they're above religion, that we're too proud to pray. But that is horseshit. We pray sometimes. Don't you?" "Every night," said Khandri. It was the truth, and yet it felt deceitful. He prayed because his birth mother had prayed beside him. He meant to go on doing so as a way to keep her near. Mektu looked unsettled by his every night, as though Khandri had issued a challenge. "Praying doesn't make you superior," he said. "We know what the prophet's done for our people. She freed us. The Chilotos were slaves. Have you ever seen the face of a slave?"
"Of course."
"Liar," said Mektu.
"Where? Up on your mountain? In your barn?"
"People pass on the road," said Khandri. Mektu sighed expansively.
"Come upstairs."
He led Khandri into his new mother's dressing chamber. Above a table littered with combs and bangles hung a portrait of a couple in wedding finery, seated and holding hands. Their faces smiled, but their eyes were deep-set and haunted, as if searching some desolate vista for a trace of whatever they had lost. They were his mother's parents, Mektu explained. They had been raised in slavery under the Vajeks, suffered unspeakable cruelties, watched nearly everyone they knew die of starvation or abuse, watched the sick or wounded tossed into mine shafts alive. When the prophet's army liberated the slave camps, they had come to Blind Stream, built the family home, raised children and dogs. Their lives were peaceful enough, although the war raged on east of the mountains. But in time, their oldest child, Payar, came to understand how wounded, how broken his parents remained in their hearts. The boy swore vengeance. He wanted to join the army and fight the Vajeks, but no one would hear of it. He was only 13. One day word reached the valley that the enemy had made a lightning advance and were closer, in fact, than at any point in years. Then Payar knew what he had to do. He stole his father's machete and slipped away in the night. The next morning, the parents found the note he had left and gave chase, and not one of them returned. Khandri looked at his brother, aghast.
What happened to them?
Mektu hesitated.
You can never speak to Ma about it. She lost her parents and her brother in one day.
I won't talk, Khandri promised. Mektu lowered his voice to a whisper.
Uncle Payar must have gotten close to the Vajeks. He was captured, and so were our grandparents. They died horribly, Khandri. They died in the Theater of Bones.
He squinted at Khandri.
You do know about the Theater of Bones.
Of course, Khandri lied. Mektu waited for him to prove it. Cheeks burning, Khandri stammered.
What's the matter? What do you want me to say? I love the Prophet as much as anyone.
After a long moment, Mektu nodded and even patted his brother awkwardly on the back.
That's the main thing, he said.
So it was. The main thing. At least for as long as love was enough, and worship something you could take or leave. For in fact, the Hingemans were indifferent to the faith. The only exceptions were their other grandfather, Lantor Hingeman's father, who had fought in the worst battles of the Satapre and made a pact with the gods at the time, and Nireti, Khandri and Mektu's eldest sister, whose devoutness nobody could explain. These two prayed together at dawn and dusk, and went to temple together. Otherwise, Khandri rarely heard so much as a mumbled prayer. He himself prayed less often with each passing season. But from that day, standing before the portrait of the grandparents slain before his birth, Khandri's love of the Prophet grew. He saw the lines of sadness enclosing Diakra Hingeman's eyes, and love for this new mother became commingled with love for the mother of all Chilodos. He listened to the priests when they visited the school, and the love blazed stronger. At last it simply dwelt in him, warm and nourishing, a bed of embers against the cold. The Prophet saved your people. She freed the slaves, she freed the valley. She routed the Shits who killed your second mother's family and left her grieving for life. The Prophet fights for you still. Although you fail her, she never fails you. Even when you pray for selfish things, she prays for you. Morning and evening, each day without exception, all her life. She herself said it often.
My people are the reason I draw breath.
Tonight, her delirious words still ringing in his ears, Khandri flees the palace compound with his comrades. Desperate to obey her, to be worthy of her prayers. Is it gone forever? That warm embrace? Has any shred of it survived the Galsinae massacre, his cracked skull, these sickening displays? Is love for that jangling, shrieking creature, that woman scrawny as a boiled stork, that murderer who spawned 11 murdering sons, even possible? How can he doubt it? How can he feel anything but doubt? Mektu is waiting for him outside the gate. Khandri, appalled at his thoughts, storms by without a word. His brother falls into step beside him, snickering, pawing at his arm.
Go and feast, she tells us, as if all of us had a great cut of boar to look forward to. Did you get to taste it, Khandri? Do you want me to sneak you a bit of fat?
Khandri shakes him off. There is a strange light in Mektu's eyes. His head makes little bobs in Khandri's direction. He is not so much walking as leaning over him, making them jostle and bump. He reaches for Khandri's arm again.
I have an idea, brother.
Sorry to hear that, says Khandri.
Do you know who comes and goes from Eternity Camp without applying for leave, without even carrying a pass?
The mole rats.
No, fool! The Zavacindrans.
Khandri has to close his eyes.
They're the answer we've been looking for, says Mektu. They can free us. Don't they claim they're here to help?
The Zavacindrans are a medical mission from the outer world, beyond Urath, beyond the quarantine. Under the plague protocols, they are the only ones allowed to come or go from the continent. Urathis are generally immune to the world plague, and that is strange enough. But the foreigners also claim that every last Urathi carries the disease.